right. Welcome back to the Buffalo Bread Podcast. Jay here with Dan. It is Friday, 8/12, and we've got some news bits to hit for our beloved Buffalo Bills in the run-up to the draft in 2 short weeks. Dan, how are you feeling, and what's been happening for you, my friend?
I am feeling like I am ready for winter to officially be over. Here in upstate New York, we have hit a nice warm patch, but it is also a rainy patch as well. If we can get past this next little cold burst we have coming in, I think I'm going to be ready for the summer, JJ. And summer, of course, means OTAs, it means training camp, preseason, and the eventual fall kickoff for your Buffalo Bills. So I feel every day as if there are signs in the universe that are bringing us one step closer to the start of the 2024 season, and I love it.
Perfect. Me too. Yeah, I'm excited to get going with this offseason and with, you know, really the offseason training, the OTAs, the mandatory minicamp, all that stuff is like, that's the time where you're excited. You're kind of living in the sorrow if you're one of the 31 franchises who don't win the Super Bowl and a big time, you know, football fan. You're living in the sorrow until those new kind of offseason training things start to kick off. If you're a team who had a coaching change, if you're a team who had major stars leave via weird trades, it's not really a time to like be hopeful for the new season until you see kind of an assembled roster and you see the free agency market, you know, wind down, and then you get excited about all your team's draft picks. So that whole kind of May 1 and on summertime where it can be quiet, and we'll probably take a slight hiatus with the pod because not a lot will happen while the league is off. But then we'll kind of return with aplomb in the early summer before kind of, you know, the season kicks off. Does that all sound good, sir?
That sounds good to me. I think, I particularly like the part about coming back with aplomb.
Yes.
There'll be an extra pep in our step, extra moxie with the pod.
Word of the pod. If you see me and Dan in public, we can, you know, that'll earn you a beer sometime. Use aplomb in a sentence. It has to work though. And you have to, it has to be right.
I've had 3 people cash that in with me here.
Yeah, me too.
It's pretty good.
I've had 1 person 3 times. So, it's a fun little game we could play though. What do we want to get done here today, Dan?
Let's talk a little bit about Bills news. There were a couple of, I would say, minor moves that the Bills have made in the past, you know, week or so since we last posted a pod. And then JJ, what I'd like to do is, I want to talk about how the rest of the AFC East is currently stacking up heading into the draft. We are a Bills-centric podcast for obvious reasons, but I think it is always helpful to talk about the Bills' chances, the Bills' roster, the Bills' overall philosophy in the context of what the other AFC East teams are doing. Because as Sean McDermott always says, it has to start with winning the division. And despite the fact that the Buffalo Bills have taken these drastic roster steps over the past month or so of the offseason, there are, I think, some silver linings when you look at the Bills' chances, at least in the AFC East, compared to where their competitors are standing right now in the Dolphins, Patriots, and Jets. So, JJ, let's talk a little bit about Bills news, but then I want to talk about what the other AFC East teams have been doing this offseason and put it into a larger context for what that might mean for Buffalo heading into 2024.
That sounds great. Let's start with, we know that the Buffalo Bills, and we've covered some of this already, the defensive line has been bolstered with a number of signings. The offensive line, the most recent, we'll talk about the ones that we haven't yet covered on a pod. The offensive line signings, most recently they signed Lyle Collins, who previously was with the Bengals and before that was with the Dolphins. Who at one time in his career was an above average kind of Pro Bowl caliber at times starter, mostly with the Cowboys. When he moved on to the Bengals, every team he's kind of moved on from has chosen to kind of send him packing or cut him with years left on his deal, which is never a good sign. But I don't know that it's personality issues. It usually comes up with injury issues. He just cannot, you know, compete at the same level and somebody takes over his starting job. And so, and he's been very successful at being kind of paid handsomely throughout his career after being an undrafted free agent and kind of falling out of the draft, he's been good at getting big time contracts, but tends to, you know, tail off and not be at the value of that money and leaving teams no reason other than cutting him. He had a massive ACL, MCL, everything in his knee got torn up in the 2022 season. He was expected to come back around and play in 2023, but then wasn't able to get on the field, kind of bounced around, was on practice squad and stuff like that near the end of the season for the Cowboys, which is a good sign. If the team that, you know, you previously moved on from is willing to bring you back into their practice squad after you've left, then it's probably not a personality issue or behavioral issue. It's probably just kind of business. And so with all that said, you know, the Bills bring in Lyle Collins. He can play. He's played, you know, a few hundred snaps at left guard and like 4,000 snaps at right tackle. So what I see there is an opportunity to challenge Spencer Brown and see where he's at. And if not that, then he might challenge David Edwards for that left guard position. And if he doesn't get a starting position on either, but shows out pretty well throughout training camp, I think you can see Lyle Collins as a premier backup for those two positions on the line.
Let me ask you this, JJ, and it may be too soon, because to your point, you got to see how healthy Collins is. But there have been simmerings. And listen, it's the off season, so it's lying season. So take all this with a big grain of salt. But there have been simmerings in some Bills insider circles that Spencer Brown could be made available via trade for the right draft capital in this year's draft, ideally nabbing the Bills, potentially that third round pick that they lost in the Rasul Douglas trade. Again, it's reading a lot into a move, but Collins is a veteran presence that we know the Bills covet. He's a clear floor raiser at a position where right now they have affected their own depth. And you've got Spencer Brown, who's heading into a contract year, and he's got one good healthy season under his belt in three. So it really does make you wonder if the Bills are considering trading Brown when he is at his peak value, because they're probably not going to be able, if he does, let's say he has a gangbusters year this year, they're probably not going to be able to afford him under the current salary cap restraints that they're facing on a new deal. And if he doesn't get hurt, you're looking at playing Collins significant time anyway. Do the Bills, while Spencer Brown has the most value in the eyes of other teams, consider moving on from him to gain some additional draft capital, JJ?
You know, I could see it. He's entering the last year of his deal. I could see Brandon Bean looking at the kind of tackle market and how free agency played out for right tackles this past, you know, the past free agency, and saying, I don't know if I want to spend, you know, I just restructured Deion Dawkins. I don't know if I want to spend a massive amount of money on both of my bookends when I can be younger vet, and then potentially this is a decent tackle draft class when it comes in terms to players who have one or two excellent traits and then a lot of question marks as to what they'll develop into. The top end of the tackle class, you know, is going to fall off before the Bills probably pick at 28. But the middle round tackle class is, like I said, it's people with a hole in their game in some regard, but not all of those gaps in talent or skills is going to be something that's not teachable. So there's a chance that you kind of double down and you pour some Cromer sauce on it on a mid round tackle to be the tackle of your future. And on a cheap deal, because younger and cheaper, again, is the theme of this. And I can see it happening. And if you get a third for Spencer Brown, you literally, you pick him with a third, a late round or late in the round third pick. And then you get two excellent and one really shaky year out of him as a starter. And then you move on from him. I think that's a pretty good, you know, that's a pretty good use of assets and resources. So I could definitely see that move happening. On the contrary, draft, develop, and resign is Brandon Bean's motto. And if you have who could be a rising star at right tackle, and you still have Deion Dawkins kind of in the middle of his prime, why the heck would you ever move away from two starting tackles, knowing that you can get Spencer Brown signed up for $16 to $20 million per year? Probably. On like a shorter deal so that he can hit free agency again. Cause I think that's the hometown discount you get. You say, hey, Spencer, we're going to give you a deal. It's not going to be top of the market, but you haven't been a top of the market player, but it's going to be a pretty short contract term so that you're still under 30 when you hit free agency again. And then if you want to get a huge bag of money and leave, we might be priced out. Because I don't think his play has proven irreplaceable value at this time. And so I think his contract would be affordable next offseason.
Yeah, all good points. All good points. I will be curious to see, because we've also floated the idea of Kyer Elam being put out there for potential trade. I do think the Bills have enough fourth round assets to move back into the third round of the draft by bundling a couple of those together to hop into like somewhere in the 90 to 100 range of that comp pick area. So I don't necessarily think that it is a likely move, but it's an intriguing move, especially with the depth of this tackle class. And like you said, the Buffalo Bills clearly believe in the coaching philosophy and coaching style of one Aaron Cromer. Otherwise, they wouldn't have deconstructed the offensive line in the way they did this offseason. So interesting stuff moving forward. But yes, overall, intrigue aside, palace intrigue aside, I think the signing of Collins is good. It's exactly what the Bills needed to do to bolster depth at a position where they had hurt their own depth. And this gives Vandermark a little bit of breathing room or the ability to prioritize him over as our primary left tackle backup in the event anything happens to Dawkins. So solid overall depth move by the Bills overall. And JJ, sneakily, as you take a look at the roster, and if you can look at it with as much objectivity as humanly possible, there are fewer and fewer holes that the Bills would need to address with their really right now, as it stands, only two premium picks in round one and round two. So they're setting themselves up to do, JJ, what I think we have all hoped they would do, which is focus on a wide receiver with pick one, ideally, but at the very least with pick two, because that is still a glaring need for this team and that room.
I agree. And I think that, you know, what we hope the Bills do is really get, I'm hopeful that between rounds one and the second pick they have in round four, they get two wide receivers. Because I think that for me, the thought of like a Julio Jones-esque trade up where they give away multiple first round assets to get into the top 10 and get somebody like Neighbors or Odunze, Marvin Harrison Jr., if something gets turned upside down and he falls, I love that player. Like, I love the idea of like premier top end talent, like the likes of which hasn't been seen in kind of 3 years of the draft. I like it. I just don't think it's worth that value. I don't think that you want to give up, you know, three or four top two round picks for one person when this is a team that really needs to hit on those picks year over year if they want to keep this like championship window open that everyone's always talking about. And so I do think that they need to kind of, in wide receiver in particular, need to get two in the top four picks of this draft. And that would make me feel very comfortable. Or one in the first, right? And then one in the fifth, right? So the two bodies is really what I'm hopeful for in such a deep wide receiver draft. We've got two bits of kind of sad news that we haven't covered yet. Vontae Davis, former Bills CB, passed away in his grandmother's home in Florida. And then O.J. Simpson has reportedly died of cancer. And so both of them had kind of, you know, one far rockier than the other off-field type things. Vontae Davis retired in kind of halftime in the first game of the year. And that has been the laughing stock and kind of a punchline for Bills Mafia for a little bit. But during his career was an excellent, you know, defensive back for a time. And then OJ Simpson, a Wall of Famer who, is also, had a Hall of Fame bust. But then also potentially killed people, has retired. He was the first rusher in the NFL to get 2000 yards. And then he squandered it all by being potentially a horrible, horrible monster. So mixed feelings there. And it's always been kind of a curious reflection on O.J. Simpson. I think it's funny because of our generation, we were not, you know, alive or watching football when he was a football player. And so that whimsical remembrance of a great, you know, talent isn't anything I carried. I remember being a child and watching the horrible, horrible trial of his, of the murder of his wife and her lover or something like that, his ex-wife and her lover. And remember, like, everybody in the entire nation being glued into the results of that, that trial, and it being kind of incredibly controversial. So,
yeah, you know, OJ's legacy as a player is one thing, but I think to your point, the generation that we grew up in, I remember when our teacher in third grade paused class so that she could tune in on the radio to listen to what the OJ verdict was. There was something that was captivating in a horrific way around OJ and that murder trial that I think had a generational type of impact for a lot of football and non-football fans moving forward. It's crazy to think that there are people now who don't know who OJ Simpson was, because to your point, that murder trial captivated our culture in a way that I think is frankly impossible now, with how split our focus is, how customizable all of our algorithms are, be it streaming or social media. There are very, very few things, good or bad, that captivate our culture these days. And OJ, I think, was at the peak of that in the 90s with the 24/7 coverage, the 24/7 news machine covering it, the newspaper print dedicated to it. You had all these media that were media forms that were, if not in their peak, not necessarily in their nadir as well. And you were as bombarded as you could have been with information about this case, sans social media. So it, in a way, it is a cultural moment that I think a lot of people has, it runs a through line through a lot of people, but it was also this fascinating media moment as well, because when taken in full hindsight, it is like a time capsule of what the power of traditional media used to be before we hit this sort of new media era that we are in now, where everybody's got a podcast, right? Yep. Everybody's got social media pages. Everybody has the ability to customize their information feed. You didn't have that ability back in the day. So significance, and I'm not saying good or bad, moral or amoral, significance in the passing of OJ Simpson, and that I am sure it's going to lead to a lot of revisiting. I would think less about his legacy as a player and more about the lasting impact. And you could fairly say the lasting negative impact that his off-the-field legacy has had in so many strains of our media culture and our social lives. And for those of you that haven't seen it, OJ Made in America, ESPN 30 for 30, I believe an Academy Award-winning documentary, really encapsulates a lot of that conversation, I think, very, very nicely.
Well, and I think that too, yeah, I've seen the documentary, and it hits the right notes of, he was at a time, he was a beloved cultural icon. He was in, you know, he was in the Naked Gun movies with Leslie Nielsen, and he was doing the Hertz commercials while he was in his playing career. He was this like super charismatic, lovable person post, you know, his playing career and turning it into an entertainment career, both in sports media and then in broader kind of Hollywood and things like that. And for that all to come down the way it came down, and for him to then be on trial for a horrible, horrific murder, was just absolutely shattering to a lot of people who had come to know him as a figure. It would be, I don't know if the I don't want to make equivalencies, because that's when we might get roasted by somebody, but like, I'm trying to think of, it'd be like Tom Brady being embroiled in like a multi-murder trial, right? Like, it's that kind of thing where it's a player that had set records and redefined a position in the league, who's mostly liked, you know, post-career, but then does something that, or is accused of and brought on trial. He was acquitted, but brought on trial for something that is absolutely horrific. And the late Norm MacDonald actually got fired from SNL for repeatedly bringing up bits about how he believed OJ was guilty of these murders.
Oh yeah, those bits have been making the round on social media again as well. Norm MacDonald, just a comic genius, genius. All right, JJ. What do you say we transition from off-field news to on-field news in the form of off-season roundup here for what the rest of the AFC East has done? So as we have said, it's always important to examine where the Bills roster is relative to what their competition is going to be. So JJ, what I'd like to do is I'd like to go in order from team that finished last, third, and then second in the division and work our last season and then work our way up to talk about some of the key additions and subtractions that they faced and kind of what their offseason plan might help us glean as far as what kind of team we think they're going to be in 2024. Let's start with last year's last place team, the New England Patriots, who, because accountability is a thing on this podcast where it may not be on many other podcasts or shows, I picked the Patriots to finish second in the division, first in defensive DVOA, and second in offensive DVOA in the AFC East last year. Wrong on all three counts. And JJ, this year, I am not drinking any such Kool-Aid, regardless of what the Patriots do. The Patriots walked into this offseason with an obscene $80 million in overall cap space. And Gerard Mayo, new head coach, basically came out early on and said, they're not going to be afraid to spend. All signs then pointed to they're going to sign a bunch of veterans because they're going to draft a rookie and have a rookie QB on contract. And around a rookie QB, everybody knows when you're in that cheap QB contract window, you surround them with capable veteran talent. JJ, I don't think the Patriots have been successful at that. Some of the most glaring weaknesses on this team last season outside of the quarterback room were wide receiver and offensive line. And the Patriots did shockingly little to build up those two areas to surround what one would assume would be a rookie QB with at least a base level floor to where they could perform and you could really see what you had in that QB. It's been a underwhelming offseason for the Patriots, JJ. And I think my overall summary of where they're at is that this is not an environment where you could plug and play a rookie QB into the current roster and expect success. I think it would be the opposite. I think if they were to draft a rookie QB, they would want to consider sitting that person and going with the ultimate bridge QB in Jacoby Brissett, who they have signed, and allow that rookie to learn behind Brissett and then forward and then focus a little bit more next year in cultivating a better free agent class for your unit when the free agent class overall is going to be better, but you'll still have a significant amount of cap space too. JJ, I just don't think the Patriots have done enough to A, be competitive in that division again, which it didn't seem like they were too far away from, but then B, bring in a rookie QB and have them see CJ Stroud kind of immediate success. What has been your take on the Patriots offseason thus far?
It seems like they wasted a lot of time going after Calvin Ridley, and then when they didn't sign him, did not have a plan. I guess that's what my biggest thought is. The Patriots are definitely going to pick a QB in the first three picks. So they pick third, I believe. They're definitely going to pick a QB because they signed Jacoby Brissett and went after reportedly no other, you know, they weren't in on Kirk Cousins or anything like that. So I believe they're going to pick QB in the first round. And then they have nobody really to, like, for him to throw to. They added Austin Hooper and let Mike Gesicki go, which for me feels like sort of a one-for-one swap. Kendrick Bourne is still solid. I think he's a good receiver. But then that's it. I mean, they have Demario Douglas. They added K.J. Osborne on a one-year, $4 million deal. Juju Smith-Schuster is still there. Literally forgot he existed in the league until, you know, the Bills played the Patriots. I was like, oh, that guy. Tyquan Thornton, Jalen Reagor, Kayshawn Boot, TJ Luther, Kawan Baker. That's sort of their wide receiver, all nine of their wide receivers at present. And then for running back in terms of weapons, they still have Ramondre Stevenson, who I think is amazing. But then they added Antonio Gibson, who I think is a good pass catching back, but not a player who sort of moves the needle at, like, kind of, you know, resetting or giving you a solid kind of RB2 for all situations if Ramondre Stevenson has any more injury issues. So it's interesting to me. And you mentioned offensive tackle being an issue. They still have Michael Onwenu, who they re-signed. And they did sign Chukwuma Okorafor, who I think is a solid signing. And so they've made those sorts of moves. But they're just like, it's... To me, it just seems like the kind of team that didn't have a great plan, didn't use its assets with so much money. They did not get a single player to add to the team who I think is like a real needle mover. To me, they just look like the same team that they were last year, except now they're going to have a rookie QB and a pass-catching running back, right? Like, they put a lot of effort and money into re-signing some of their stars, which I think is smart. They ended up getting Kyle Duggar back on a four-year deal, who's probably one of the best safeties in the league. But it just doesn't seem like they did enough to add any pressure or kind of put any stress on the Bills or the Dolphins at the top of the AFC East.
This was a team, JJ, that finished 32nd in pass block win rate on that offensive line. When you're talking about getting a rookie QB into the mix here for this New England Patriots team, you've got to block for them. Like, have teams learned nothing from the Bryce Young experiment in Carolina, where he was running for his life behind the line all of his rookie season? To me, JJ, I've never thought the Patriots were fully sold on taking a QB with a third overall pick. I've always thought that's been more media buzz. When you look at overall on this roster, defensively, they tend to be more solid, but offensively, this is a team where the cupboard is really, really bare. And to your point, the only major move that you made in the offseason on offensive line was to bring back Onuenu, who could feature at guard or feature at tackle, who was already part of an offensive line that had the worst pass block win rate in the league. So not an upgrade, excuse me, but at least a stabilizer for what was a very mediocre below average line. So to me, they've got to upgrade at several positions, the skill positions being one of them. I'm not as sold as you are on Stevenson. Stevenson actually had some really good holes and lanes that offensive line was able to create for him last year. And I just don't think he's got the burst to take advantage of those. I just think he's kind of like this plodding, runs really upright, very square type of running back. And I just don't think, he is someone that you get scared of at the skill position level. So they need to upgrade a tackle. They need to upgrade at their interior of their offensive line. They need a QB. They need a wide receiver. Tight end, to your point, they traded Mike Gesicki for Mike Gesicki Jr. And then they don't have anybody in the wide receiver room that I think you could say is a number one. Or let's say that they don't want a number one. Let's say they want an amalgamation of capable receivers. I don't even think the floor on that room is that high, because we saw them last year with Mac Jones in what will be a similar offense this year, granted with a new QB. Now, Jacoby Brissett, you could argue, is going to be an upgrade over Mac Jones. I think we could all agree with that. But they haven't done enough to me, JJ, to upgrade this offense in a meaningful way. The disparity between defensive production for this team last year and offensive production was equaled in gap only by what the New York Jets were able to do. But the Jets at least won some games last season. To me, the New England Patriots should absolutely do one of two things with the third pick. Trade back with a team like Minnesota or the Giants, who might be looking to get up and get their QB of the future. Get a windfall of draft capital and premium picks this season and next season, and start to build out a core and take a guy like Bo Nix in the second round, or take a flyer on a kid like Spencer Rattler, right, in the third or fourth round. But this is not a team to me, JJ, that seems situated to bring in their QB of the future and have that person succeed. They already swung and missed with Mac Jones, and you could argue the situation Jones came into is far better than whatever this rookie QB is going to be coming into should they choose to draft one. To me, the Patriots need to defer, especially with the miss rate on first-round QBs being as high as 70% in some draft years. I just don't think the Patriots should dabble in these waters right now. Trade back or take Marvin Harrison Jr., or the wide receiver one who you think is best on your board. Take that person at three, or trade back and start to accumulate some younger, cheaper, cost control talent for the future.
Absolutely. I think that they need so much help. That's the problem, is they need a complete rebuild. And we know from watching the Buffalo Bills when Josh Allen was a rookie and kind of pushed into starting, that he had no help from the wide receiver room. They had a minimum floor wide receiver room, which is similar to kind of where the Patriots wide receiver room is right now. And it wasn't until Cole Beasley, Stephon Diggs, some of those premium talents at that point of their careers were brought in, that Josh Allen flourished. And so I just don't see a QB they take at three really having the capacity to do anything special with the talent around him on this roster. I think you're right. I think it's a multiple year rebuild. I will say that their defense is probably going to still be very, very solid. They did not lose a lot, but they didn't lose a lot of talent, but they also added some like small key pieces here and there. So I do think that, you know, it's probably going to be the same thing we saw last year. As a Bills fan, I hope they take a quarterback with the third pick, and I hope that that quarterback is another massive bust, because that just means another 4 or 5 years of the Bills, you know, having the Patriots number while they try to figure it out, and probably another coaching change. So I'm all about that possibility, but you're right. If I'm a Patriots fan, if I'm Brandon, I want them to either hit it out of the park with a QB who makes everyone about him better, because that's the kind of talent they need given this room on offense, or trade back, like you said, and get a bounty of picks you can use to build that core.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Josh's first season in Buffalo is a really good comp, because that was not a roster that was intended to be passed over to a rookie QB. There is a risk in taking a QB with the third pick, having Brissett go down, and then your best laid plans go up in smoke, because now you've got to play this rookie behind in a less than ideal developmental situation. So, I mean, to me, if I'm the Patriots and I am a team, granted this was all Belichick, but if I'm an organization that has not shown the ability to build an offense outside of having the greatest quarterback of all time, like if I have not been able to build a consistent offense without that person, I don't know that I trust the track record of this unit yet to really thread that needle on a rookie QB pick and then use the rest of this draft capital to select meaningful pieces to support that rookie. I think this has to be a spaghetti at the wall situation for the Patriots. They just need to have as many irons in the draft fire as they can. And to me, that would be a trade back. So JJ, we're gonna rank this team on a brand new scale that we're rolling out here for Buffalo Bread, on a scale of chicken wings, 4 being the scariest and the hottest, 1 being the most mild and least terrifying to you. On a scale of 1 to 4 chicken wings, how much do the Patriots scare you?
To clarify, are these wings with blue cheese?
The wings are always with blue cheese.
Thank you.
And the fact that you had to ask that question, you don't know me. After that all these years, you don't know me.
No, that was a softball to endear ourselves to Bill's Mafia.
Yeah, we're pandering. We're pandering.
Yes, we're pandering. I would say 0.5 of a 1. Like, it's the kind of chicken wing spice level that your like elderly grandmother who like always says, don't make it too hot when you just use black pepper in a recipe. I have no fear about this Patriots team. And that's a Patriots team that they split with the Bills last year. But I think that split was more about the defensive upheaval with the injuries and figuring themselves out than it was the actual quality of the roster, because that was an outlier for the whole season for the Patriots.
Yeah. Mac Jones to date, and probably forever, Mac Jones only career fourth quarter comeback against the Buffalo Bills. So let me posit this then. Rather than half a chicken wing, how about we go with 1 boneless wing, right?
Sure,
how about we introduce that?
Not
to
a
the
real
scale?
Chicken wing. Yeah.
Yep. A
so
chicken
it's 1
nugget.
Boneless wing. Yeah. You get a chicken nugget, Patriots.
All right. Brandon is not going to be happy about that for the mock draft next week. All right. Next, let's move on to the New York Jets, who, I mean, JJ, we all knew what the hype was going in for them last season. Aaron Rodgers, amazing defense, finally going to unlock Garrett Wilson here as he takes a step above his second season. We all know what happened with Rodgers getting injured, the Achilles tear, the drama around will he, won't he come back, Zach Wilson's complete and utter inefficacy, and then what has really bubbled up in the offseason is just a lot of like ego and drama and paranoia in the New York Jets locker room, which I don't know I found necessarily surprising, you know, based on some of the Diana Russini reporting, I think, around what that squad was like last season. But JJ, nonetheless, they finished 3rd in the AFC East last year. They are returning Aaron Rodgers. They have, to me, this is like the YOLO season for the New York Jets. They have added a lot of veteran talent on short-term or one-year deals. Many of these veterans having questionable injury histories. They are really trying to elevate the floor of this offense so that what will probably be another stellar defense will not go wasted like it did last year. So, JJ, what are your thoughts on the New York Jets offseason, and where do we feel they are as far as a threat to the Buffalo Bills go?
So I think that, you know, you and I would have both agreed in the offseason in 2023 that the New York Jets, New Jersey Jets in Florham Park, New Jersey, needed to have a better offensive line for a less mobile veteran quarterback, pocket passer like Aaron Rodgers. And they didn't, right? They did not invest in that. They brought a bunch of Aaron Rodgers buddies who were on big time ticket deals and were very poor performers over with him and let him kind of determine the roster. And that seemed to be a massive failure. So this offseason, they decided to double down and pick up Tyron Smith, the 8-time Pro Bowl, you know, selection on a 1-year contract. However, he's missed 37 games over the past 4 seasons. Like, that is not tenable. The Cowboys using him last year, they kept him out of all live practice drills, not just like, oh, you're not going to hit today, but like all live practice drills where people needed to move their legs and move in space and have contact with each other, which showed in his play, because as much as he's been an amazing tackle during his career, he definitely looked slow, old, and ineffective last season. And so it's really, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And again, as a Bills fan, I'm relishing this. I'm loving the fact that they bring in kind of Mike Williams, who tore his ACL last season in week 3, and he turns 30 in October during the season, has always been an injury risk. They bring in him in from the Chargers. They kind of double down. They get Tyrod Taylor as a backup QB to try to have an insurance policy in case Aaron Rodgers gets hurt again. They get John Simpson, who's a solid. That's a solid signing. That's one good solid signing. So they have a replacement for left guard Laken Tomlinson, and that's part of the rebuild. And so I like that. That's a good pick. But they picked him as a hopeful prospect over some really kind of slam dunk prospects like Robert Hunt and Jonah Jackson in free agency, while having kind of the money to do things. And then a kicker, a punter, you know, and some defensive pieces are kind of the big signings they made. So signing one left tackle and one left guard, and having the left tackle be a injury riddled, you know, veteran, and the left guard be a hopeful project, is just like, you know, and I want to say John Simpson is probably going to be pretty, I like him. But I'm just, I don't know, man, as a Bills fan, I'm loving it. Cause I just don't think that they have done enough to ensure against Aaron Rodgers going down again, or to provide enough protection, reliable protection, snap after snap. You know, all you need is kind of a couple of long drives, and then I bet you see Tyron Smith come off with whomever they have as a backup.
Yeah, and the addition of Simpson and Morgan Moses, both from the Baltimore Ravens, it's a signal to me that they really want to try to make Breece Hall more of a focal point of this offense, which I think is smart. The question is Aaron Rodgers going to allow for it? And then do you have the confidence that Nathaniel Hackett is going to be the guy that schemes it? I mean, to me, I've seen a lot of media personalities say this is a high risk, high reward type of offensive offseason for the Jets, but I don't even think it's that high reward. And I don't think the Jets are looking necessarily or expecting this to go from an offense that could barely score 17 to an offense that'll consistently score 27. I think they want to field an offense that is going to close the efficiency gap with what is a world beater defense, and still will be next season. And I think they're just trying to get to average on offense, much as was the expectation last year. Because last year they went in with knowing holes at wide receiver 2 and offensive line. This season they've put a patchwork together of some veteran presences that, if healthy, will be okay. But then you still have Nathaniel Hackett scheming this offense and calling plays for this offense. And you still have Robert Saleh, who jury is out if this dude can be a head coach in the NFL. And then you have the toxicity of last season still permeating this clubhouse, allegedly. The one smart move I think the Jets made was bringing in Tyrod Taylor as their backup QB. No one ever wants to see a player get hurt, even a player as annoying and self-important as Aaron Rodgers. No one ever wants to see a player get hurt. No one should ever root for those things. But in the inevitability that you're now 40-plus-year-old quarterback who's coming off an Achilles injury, does have to miss time next season behind a patchwork offensive line, you at least have arguably the most reliable backup in the league in Tyrod Taylor to kind of steer the ship. Question is, what do you do with Zach Wilson? Because no one seems interested in trading for him at this point. So he is also still sitting out there on the roster. So is there a world where Zach Wilson is like practice squad eligible and he's like your emergency third QB? Like that whole situation is still looming there. But to me, JJ, this is a YOLO season, because if this season does not work out from a personnel standpoint for the Jets, Sala won't be there, Douglas won't be there, and that is a team that is looking for a reset. And even if this team makes the playoffs this season, with a 40-year-old quarterback and all these veteran additions on offense, it is not like you are building anything for the future outside of Garrett Wilson. So the question of sustainability of the success of this team is going to come into question as well. I think they are putting a lot of their eggs, not in the Aaron Rodgers basket, but in the "this defense is really good" basket, and has not seen the type of regression to the mean that other defenses have seen over the past few seasons. I still think it's a really good defense, and I think they're going to try to strike while a lot of these young guys are cheap and cost-controlled and in their prime. Because they just paid Quinnen Williams, I want to say. They're going to have to pay Sauce Gardner. And then you got a real-life question about what you got to do with DJ Reed as well, once he comes due for an extension. So, JJ, well, yeah, go ahead.
And to just kind of piggyback off of the defensive line conversation with the Jets, they did something so curious to me, which was Bryce Huff leaves and signs with the Philadelphia Eagles as a free agent, and they trade for Hassan Reddick.
They trade draft capital for Hassan Reddick.
So they trade a third that could be a second if Hassan Reddick has an excellent season to the Eagles for a pass rusher who, mind you, has been good the last couple seasons. I think it's a good addition, but he's over 30, is at or over 30, and they let a in his 20s, in his prime, pass rusher who I think you and I would both agree I was afraid of when the Bills played against them.
Bryce Huff, in limited snaps, yeah, that guy scared
as a situational like third long and late down pass rusher, he was always in Josh Allen's grill, and so I think that it was I'm just like, that's such a curious move. Projects to me potentially that Bryce Huff didn't want to sign with the Jets, which may be a reflection of how he feels this team build is going, because he was a situational only pass rusher often. He might just be like, send me to a team, or I'm going to a team, I'm going to sign with a team that tells me I'm going to be their number one defensive end, kind of on a 3-4 defense, because he's an outside linebacker who is a situational pass rusher with the Jets. And if that's the case, you know, I get why he walked. But it's just so, I'm like, oh, you know, you could have afforded Bryce Huff with the money that you're agreeing to pay Hassan Reddick, and you got older and you got, you know, slightly less upside.
Yeah, this is the variance on the Jets is either they could finish last or they could finish first. And there's not, I don't think, room for an in-between this season. So JJ, on our chicken wing scale, 4 being the hottest and scariest, and 1 or boneless being the least scary, where do you think the Jets fall? This is a tough one for me because that defense is so good. But where do you think the Jets fall?
So for me, it's a 3 if Aaron Rodgers is healthy for 14 or more games, and it's a 2 if he's healthy for 10 or less games.
I'm gonna say 2. And I'm going to stay firm at 2. And here's the reason why. That is a scary defense, but that is a defense that was built to beat Daboll and Dorsey. I think Brady wants to run a lot of heavier sets. I think he wants to run the ball. He wants to exploit short area yardage. And that is not the strength of this New York Jets defense. The Jets want to put a roof on you down the field. They want to lock down the boundaries. They want to force you into passing into the intermediate middle parts of the field. And I just don't think Brady is going to take that bait. And I don't think the Jets have the ability, when they condense down, to really lock down in a similar way over the top. This is a team that wants to basically play a nickel package like the Bills do. They want to rush 4 and get home with 4. if the Bills can establish the run game and stunt some of that pass rush heaviness that the Jets are going to bring to the table, I don't think the Jets have the personnel to adjust. So I actually think the Jets defense, if Brady sticks to his core philosophy, I'm not saying the Bills will dominate. What I'm saying is it's now a more favorable matchup for the Bills as opposed to what it was for Daboll and Dorsey, who wanted to drop Josh back or put Josh in shotgun 99% of the time and let those Jets pass rushers have a field day with him. I don't think Brady is going to put Allen in the same situation. And I don't think the Jets are set to deal with this kind of retro offensive look. So I'm going to go 2. And regardless of what happens in the draft or with Rodgers, I do think the Bills should be a scary matchup for the Jets, offense and defense wise.
Well, and I agree completely. I think that the New York Jets have an excellent defense, as we've talked about several times in this segment. But their linebackers beyond C.J. Mosley are not run stuffers. I guess Chaz Surratt out of North Carolina could be considered kind of that downhill thumper. But most of them are lighter coverage type linebackers. And I give me every single snap of Spencer Brown spilling out to take on Sauce Gardner on a zone run. Like every snap. Because Sauce Gardner's not, he is physical with receivers. He is weak when he has to kind of fit the run. And that's, I think, why they play the defense they play in the similar ways that the Bills, you know, try to hide certain players in their defensive backfield who they know are not kind of at the muster to hold the point of attack. And I think I agree completely in that the Bills will be able to handle this team in terms of playing a more physical style of football and kind of running it straight at them, which is, again, you know, yet another endorsement of the Bills to go out and get Braylon Allen or Audric Estime in the 4th round if they're available to have kind of that thunder to Cook's lightning.
Thunder to Cook's lightning. I love it. Yes, absolutely. All right, JJ, now let's move on to the team that I think we could both say safely has been the chief competitor to the Bills over the last 2 seasons, the Mike McDaniel-led Miami Dolphins. JJ, I was puzzled by the Dolphins' offseason last year because I feel like they willfully ignored areas of need for themselves. And because they were so fast and schemed so well and their schedule was so weak last season, I think they were able to hide for a lot of their deficiencies. I don't know that they're going to be able to hide it this year. They lost a lot of talent on the offensive and defensive side of the ball, particularly in the trenches where this team was its weakest. So last year, the offensive line was a problem for this team. And it is crazy to think that they had a 4,000-yard passer in Tua Tagovailoa, but they had the 30th best, so third worst, pass block win rate in the entire league. The Dolphins 30, Jets 31, Patriots 32, respectively, JJ, and pass block win rate last season to tell you how bad those O-lines were. But because of the, we'll say, hubris and intelligence of one Mike McDaniel, this is a team that feels like it can be somewhat quarterback-proof, and because of how quick they want to get the ball out, they can also be somewhat offensive line-proof. But we saw when good defenses shut down the anticipatory windows that Tua wanted to throw to last season, this was not a team that could stay with good, even average defenses. They really did feast on a lot of weaker competition last year. So JJ, they've had losses to areas that were already, in my opinion, weak for them. They lost Robert Hunt, to your point. They lost Christian Wilkins, thank freaking God, yes, on the defensive line. Thank goodbye to that guy. Have fun in Vegas, man. Whatever.
Yeah. We'll see you once a year, maybe.
Right. And they've tried to patch it together with guys like one Jordan Poyer, right? Shaq Barrett, linebacker formerly of Tampa Bay. They've brought in Jonnu Smith, who I think is a sneaky good signing for them, because they really did have a big hole. They did have a big hole in their tight end room last season. And I think a guy like Smith, while New England could not unlock his natural athletic traits, I think in Miami he could be a force. But, you know, Isaiah Wynn they bring back. You know, they've got Kendall Fuller on the roster now. Braxton Berrios they bring back. JJ, to me, this is a team that is in a worse position than it was in 2023. And they've doubled down on a lot of the same holes. And again, they don't have a lot of draft capital or cap space heading into September to really fill a lot of these holes. So they need another wide receiver. That was proven last year, especially with Tyreek Hill and Jalen Waddle trading off on injuries throughout the course of the season. They didn't have a reliable third option. Maybe Smith can be that for them. I don't know. This is not an offensive line that held up when Tua's window, anticipatory window, closed and he couldn't get the ball out in 2.3 seconds. JJ, I know they're fast and I know McDaniel is a good coach, but this is back-to-back off seasons for me where it seems like they feel like they're the smartest guys in the room. And as a result of that, they can always scheme or work their way out of, to me, what are obvious personnel issues and personnel needs. What is your take so far on the Dolphins offseason, JJ?
Well, it's interesting because I think that they have net losses on both offensive and defensive line. And by net losses, you might look at it and be like, well, they have more bodies than they did kind of before free agency started on both lines. But I would say that there are two signings that would be considered somewhat significant to depth and then to the center that they have in place, you know, because Connor McDermott
Connor Williams.
Their best offensive linemen were Connor Williams and Robert Hunt. Connor Williams is a free agent because he tore his ACL and is like waiting to see, you know, how that recovers before a team signs him. Could come back to the Dolphins, but they, you know, put insurance against that by signing who is it? The guy out of the Titans. I'm going to look it up here. So they signed Aaron Brewster, the center from the Titans.
Brewer.
They signed him to fill that hole and lost Robert Hunt, lost Connor Williams. And so really they got worse because then they also have a backup, kind of a backup rotational guard. They signed some of their, you know, Wynn and Jones re-signed, but they did not get better there. And then on the defensive line, when you leave Christian Wilkins out in the cold because you're waiting on the contract, you know, that you're going to have to pay to Tua, he goes to Vegas and you get worse there too. So in the trenches where I think you highlighted, their pass rush win rate was terrible. They lost their two best players, one during the season and one in free agency, and replaced them with two middling players. And then on the defensive line, which wasn't, you know, I think it's curious because they lost Jalen Phillips and who's the pass rusher from the other edge?
Bradley Chubb.
They lost them both in season, and so neither of them is going to be back until at the earliest playoffs, and they're probably not going to be back at form due to the nature of their injuries, Achilles and ACL. I think that's the thing, is we focus on what the teams have done in the trenches first because that matters every snap. Your wide receiver, your running back, they're not going to touch the ball every snap, but an offensive and defensive lineman is going to touch an opponent every single snap. And so they got net worse on both sides of the trenches. So, and then you have Tyreek Hill, who's 1 year older and during the latter part of the season did not look as bursty or speedy, as his, you know, incredible lightning self usually, because, you know, teams were playing him too physical and he was being taken out of the games.
Yeah. Last season, I think, and I've got to look at the metrics because there's great metrics out there from PFF, Stathead and some other places that show you the success rate of a wide receiver against press coverage. And it seemed like last season, JJ, teams were pressing Tyreek Hill more and more. I mean, I know the L'Jarius Sneed video went viral of him. Pressed him into Cancun or something like that. Like Hill was dominated in that playoff game against KC. There's no doubt about it. But it's a team that, listen, and I know I'm on an island with this because I know the media loves Mike McDaniel and how cool and smart he is. This is a team that feels still one-dimensional, and it's a team that feels like good teams and good coaches have figured out, and it doesn't feel like anyone is scared of this team this season. It'll be interesting to see how their schedule shakes out and what the cadence of that schedule looks like because, again, this is still a roster and a scheme that is built for beating bad teams. But if they got to play a few more winning teams, JJ, or a few more playoff teams, I don't know that this Dolphins squad is going to be as successful as they have been the past couple of seasons. It just, they don't have enough draft capital or enough cap space to really get better at a lot of these key areas. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. They've got the 21st pick. Like the Patriots, to me, they are a trade down candidate in the first round, particularly if there is a team like a Carolina that wants to get up and maybe get a wide receiver or a tackle that is unexpectedly dropped. But then again, if you're the Dolphins, you should be taking that tackle. Or if it's Jackson Powers Johnson, or if who's the Duke kid? Graham Barton.
Graham Barton, yeah.
Yep, if he's there, right? Even a Zach Frazier to me, who I think a surprising amount of teams will have a first round grade on. I think if you're the Dolphins, you really got to consider trading back with a team like Baltimore or Kansas City, which is not ideal because they're your AFC competitors, but you could still get a great offensive lineman there and accumulate more draft capital. Because JJ, I don't know what they do. And to your point, they still need to figure out if they're going to sign Tua to the long term. And he's going to be due for at least an average per year contract of around $40 million. Everyone is using the Daniel Jones line now to bargain for their clients. And regardless of what you think about Tua, he's better than Daniel Jones. Yeah. So,
absolutely. Well, and I'll add one more point, and that's that their defensive backfield, I think, got worse. They Xavier Howard was not a positive, you know, not a plus starter for the last year, probably year and a half. And so parting ways with him was smart. But to add Jordan Poyer, who I think we both love, I know you do, and I do too, has meant so much to Buffalo during his time there. He is at the end of his career, and it's noticeable. His ability to kind of mix it up, and specifically his ability to click and close when he reads the play at speed, is almost gone at this point. I think that what we saw with him in his ball production, kind of, you know, playing the deep third, and then his amazing, you know, run fits in Buffalo, those things you saw every game in and game out for 4 years. In this past season, you didn't see that, right? Like, you saw it in fits and starts. It was like a, you know, an overhead light with a kind of a loose wire. Every once in a while, the bulb came on, but it wasn't consistent. And so I think that was a kind of worse. I mean, Javon Holland's a stud. He's great. So I think that they have that. But if either one of them is hurt, and we know Jordan Poyer's missed some time of the past two seasons with injury, even though he's a Warrior, I think that they're kind of weak behind them. And then for their backup to their nickel cornerback at this point in time is Saron Neal. And as a Bills fan, I was in panic mode every time that was the immediate next backup for the Bills going into a game. If they didn't have somebody else to come in, I was worried. And so I think that's, you know, their defensive backfield got worse this offseason. Jalen Ramsey, I think, you know, coming into a healthy season is certainly an upgrade over any of the cornerbacks they've had over the past couple of years. Kendall Fuller's a good signing as an unrestricted from Washington. But their safety position and their nickel, I don't think is any better.
So JJ, let's get to chicken wing rankings here. So again, this is a team that has had back-to-back seasons in the postseason, early exits. And over the last three seasons, playoffs included, the Buffalo Bills are 6-1 against the squad. JJ, how scary, in a chicken wing term, is this team to you?
They're a 4 boneless or a 3 bone-in wing for me. And the 4 boneless is, I say this, let me expand on that. It's because I think that on paper and what they produce indicates to me that they're always going to be neck and neck or ahead of the Bills for the division lead, because if they're playing a lesser schedule, they're going to be up there. Because they beat up on smaller competition with Tyreek Hill, with Tua delivering the ball. They still have that speed. And Devin Achane came out and was an amazing pick for them. I think they're still threatening, and they're still offensive production is always going to win in this game. And so I think for that reason they're a 4, but it's boneless because against premier competition, a lot of that talent folds.
Yeah. This might be the most controversial rating I give, up there with my Patriots Kool-Aid drinking last season. This team is a 1 to me. Again, 6-1 over the last three seasons against the Josh Allen-led Buffalo Bills. And if you want to go back further, we know Josh has owned this particular squad. At this point, I think the league has caught up to what McDaniel is doing offensively. We'll see if they can piece it together on defense. I know they brought in a new defensive coordinator that a lot of league circles are very high on. Could be a future head coach, but this is a team to me, kind of like the LA Chargers with Brandon Staley. They think they're smarter than everybody, and they don't realize that everyone has kind of caught up to what they want to do. So unless I see some sort of adjustment from the squad and offensive philosophy, I am not scared. I am not scared of the Miami Dolphins. I would be more scared of the Jets at this point than I would be of the Dolphins, based on roster build but recent history.
Well, this episode's been braggadocious, Dan.
I don't think about where we've been. We've been like, man, Bills are going to have a losing record. Oh, top 10 pick 2025. Yeah. Here we come, right? But then when you take a look at where the rest of the AFC East is, I think it is safe to say that other than the Jets offensively, everybody's overall floor got worse in the AFC East. So the question is the Bills' floor now lower than the rest of these other teams? And I actually think it's a lot more positive for the Bills than we think. When you take the Bills in isolation, oh my God, Stephon Diggs is gone. Oh my God, we lost Jordan Poyer. We lost all these leaders on the team. Take it in isolation, it's devastating. But you take it into the context of the teams they're going to have to play six times a year and ultimately get through to win the division. It's not as apocalyptic, I think, as we thought it would be. Because a lot of these teams, they're in their own versions of resets and rebuilds too, and they have not been as stewarded as well as the Bills. So if you were to ask me today, I still think the floor on the Buffalo Bills win floor is 7 or 8, and I think the ceiling is 10. But I think 10 wins this division.
I think that I'm with you, though. And the thing you said there that kind of perked me up was stewardship. And I'm just thinking about these other rosters. And we study the Patriots, Jets, and Dolphins as much as kind of any team in the league, of course, because they're in the division. I can't think of many outstanding new young talents that any of those three teams have gotten in the past few years, other than, you know, Wilson and Sauce Gardner for the Jets. I mentioned Devin Achain for the Dolphins. And like, it's not, they don't have a lot of, you know, they haven't been drafting well, I think is the problem. The Jets have a couple more hits, I think, than the Bills, but they've also been picking so high year over year. And so it's a question of like, who's building their rosters the right way, draft, develop, and re-sign. And I think it's just the Bills, and then maybe as a distant second, the Jets. And by that measure, it makes sense that for you, Dan, your ratings are a 2 or a 3 for the Jets, and then, or I'm sorry, a hard 2 for the Jets, and then a 1 for everyone else. I'm a little bit higher on the Dolphins because I still think that their offense can produce and kind of cause some problems in the division. But yeah, I mean, when you look at the Bills, you know, hitting on Osiris Torrance, Dalton Kincaid, who are both kind of really bright stars after just 1 year of production, James Cook, Terrell Bernard, even, you know, somebody like Christian Benford, right? A solid starting cornerback picked up in the later rounds. The Bills have hit on a lot of things, and their win rate in the draft has been pretty good the last 2 seasons. So, really looking forward to that and kind of taking hope from it.
Absolutely, JJ. Absolutely. So that is it for our AFC East roundup here. So next week we will dive into our very, very fun Friends of the Pod, not Friends of the Bills, 3-round mock draft with all of our various hosts, guests, and fans of other AFC East teams coming in to do a mock draft with us, leading into the real draft, which is blessedly only 2 weeks away at this point. So until then, for all of you listening at home, like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Google, Apple, Spotify, and as always, go Bills!